Livewire with Jason Moyle.
Hello, I'm Jason, and joining me on Livewire today, I'm very pleased to say that we've got Dig Wayne from the band Joe Boxers. Hello, Dig.
Hello, how are you doing? How you doing, Jason?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm fine. Right, so we're going to go back to where it all started for you, but also, because you've now reformed in the last couple of years, we'll be talking about the what's coming up as well. And so you formed back in the early 80s, and in the early days, the band had a kind of working man's look to it, didn't it? How did that come about?
Well, basically, it came about from my love of Marlon Brando on the waterfront, that particular movie, these dock workers. I loved that look. I love that movie. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And the guys in the band, you know, I came over from New York in 82, and, you know, they were wearing Dickie boats and, you know, they were looked like smart young men with Vic Goddard and at Club Left in the West End. And so when we got together and decided to, you know, start something brand new, it's like we needed an image. It's like, you know, so what could we possibly, you know, latch on to that we were excited about, that we could relate to, that didn't cost a lot of money, which was very important, that we could kind of whip up without a lot of investment, just basically ideas and being creative. And I had never heard of Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Okay.
That was before Come On Eileen was a hit. So the Dexys had no profile in America at all. So, and they turned me on to Dexys. So when I saw Dexys Midnight Runners, I thought, oh my God, these guys are great. You know, they had, at the time they had that sort of, you know, the beanies and the watch cap, the little duffel bags. They kind of had a waterfront look going, you know, so I thought that was pretty cool. But actually that was their older look. By then, I think they had moved into dungarees and different things by then. So, you know, there's Sean and Dave, Rob and Chris, they love Dexy. So I thought, well, that's cool. And so I like that. So I thought, well, let's kind of use that influence and I brought the American edge to it, you know, with the waterfront thing, with the, you know, New Jersey waterfront. And plus it was those two things. Plus it was also a combination of, you know, a vintage idea. You know, 40s, 50s, you know, braces, which we call suspenders, and, you know, bait braces and a belt, which is always a weird thing to wear, braces and a belt. Like, you don't trust your belt. You got to back up your belt with suspenders or braces. And it just kind of evolved from there. Plus, you know, I always had an appreciation for, you know, the 1940s and the 1950s. I mean, I had a rockabilly band in New York that was, you know, from the 50s, and that we always wore all 50s clothes. So, you know, so the flat caps, and being in England at that time, I don't know, there was something about London that I, you know, I would go into these shops like a cobbler's, get something fixed, go to different places. And I saw all these old guys going around, you know, these old guys with flat caps, you know, that were still kind of reminiscent of, the war years or something.
Yeah.
You know? Strangely enough, in the early 80s, there were still guys who looked like that, who were still older men who still look like that. And I thought that was really good. I thought, you know, we should steal something from old guys, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, so the flat caps kind of came around, and then also the Bowery Boys. That was another part of it. Those old 1940s movies with the Bowery Boys, you know, Hunts Hall and Leo Gorcey, you know, the Dead End Kids. And that was a part of it too. You know, I had some caps made that were basically based right on the Hunts and Leo Gorcey's. His name was Slip in the movies. Leo Gorcey was the actor, and he had these particular kind of little beanies that he used to wear with holes in them and stuff. And I had someone make me some caps, you know, little beanies like that. So there was a combination of things going on. And in the end, it just became, you know, Joe Boxers, you know, just looked like Joe Boxers.
Okay. And you had your big break on the BBC television program, Oxford Roadshow, because there was a scout there, wasn't there, that picked you up.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time ago. I can't remember exactly how it went step by step, but I do remember they wanted that we recorded a little video of Johnny Friendly, the song Johnny Friendly, which was based on the Waterfront. And they played it on the Oxford Road Show. And that was our first kind of wide exposure on the BBC, I believe it was. Yeah, it was on BBC. That was the first time people actually saw us, you know, on television.
Yeah, and you got picked up, and instead of recording from about November 1982, and obviously your first hit was Boxer Beat. So tell us a bit about Boxer Beat, because it's one that you're obviously well known for, and it's quite iconic from the 80s, really. Still, yeah. People remember it so well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was one of those things, again, it's a long time ago. I don't remember how the song actually came together step by step, but one of the things I do remember is I always loved Do You Love Me by the Contours. You know, it starts off, you broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. Now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. You know, one of those kind of intros. And there was another song by Archie Bell and the Drells, which the New York Dolls covered, called Showdown. And it had that same kind of an intro, like, say, man, they tell me you're pretty good. Don't you know you're in my neighborhood? You know, so it was that kind of an intro. So I thought we need that, some sort of an intro. And plus, it was our theme song. We needed a theme song, you know, Madness, even though they didn't write the song Madness. It was a cover, but it became their theme song. You know, groups would write their theme song, you know, Big Country in a Big Country. You know, everybody kind of had a song that was their song that mentioned the name of the band. It was their theme. And so we needed a theme. And I think Rob, the guitar player, came up with the initial riff. And then he and Dave, the piano player, they worked out, you know, the chords and this and that. And I wrote the lyrics and titled it Boxer Beat. I don't know how I thought Boxer Beat, but it just seemed to make sense. And it's a very positive song. If you listen to the lyrics, it's a very positive song. I'm not sure how many people actually understand what I'm talking about in that song, but it's a very positive lyric. And it just took off. And we were very surprised. We didn't want it to be our first single, actually, because we just didn't. And it was a blessing and a curse at the same time for it to go to number three. Your first record goes to number three, then where do you go from there, you know?
Yeah, and you had quite two big songs ahead of you as well, didn't you? I think you had Let's Dance by David Bowie and Duran Duran also ahead of you. So you may have been another week's, may have been number one with that. But yeah, so, and then you followed it up with another great song, Just Got Lucky, which broke you in America.
That's right. It really did. It got to the number, got to the top 30 in the States. And we got to do, it enabled us to do a tour over here. I saw America in a way I'd never seen it before by living here my whole life. You know, I moved to London, then I come back and get to see America. It was strange, you know, that we did this big tour, you know, traveling in a big coach across the country, drove from Champaign, Illinois to San Diego in a big tour bus. And that was very exciting. It was very exciting. Got to do the show called Solid Gold, which was, you know, one of those dance shows. And had a lot of bands on it. I think Mary McCoo and Billy D. Williams were, not Billy D. Williams, but Billy, I can't think of his name. They were in the Fifth Dimension. They were the host of the show. And, you know, it was great. My mother saw it. Oh, you're on Solid Gold. And, you know, so it was very exciting.
Yeah. And then Johnny Friendly, you released Johnny Friendly, which was another hit for you in the UK. And also had Frank Bruno in the video, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, we had Frank Bruno in the video. By then we had a pretty good reputation around. People knew who we were. We'd had a couple of hit records, been in the top 10 twice. You know, I don't know what number in the charts Johnny Friendly reached, but it wasn't very high. I personally thought Johnny Friendly should have been the first single, and then we went from there. And then you know, I don't know, we went the wrong direction. You know, we went from number three to number seven to I don't know what Johnny Friendly got to. But yeah, it was one of my favorite songs. I love that song.
Because that paid homage to Molten Brando, didn't it? That's the one that.
Yeah, that was the one. It's all about on the waterfront. I track the lyrics right through the whole plot of the movie. If you listen to the lyrics, if you know the movie, you can listen to those lyrics and follow the story of the film, the plot of the film right through. And Frank Bruno, I forget who had the idea to get Frank Bruno involved, but somebody knew Terry Lawless, who was his manager at the time. And they were like, yeah, sure. It was a great promotion for both of us, you know, and he was great. Frank was great. I remember that day we shot that. Frank was great. It was really exciting when we first met him. You know, he's huge. You know, we had this giant guy, you know, and he was so young at the same time. He was very young and massive and just like, you know, he's like a big teddy bear. He was sweet. He was a sweetheart. You know, he wasn't aggressive. He was really nice. He played right along with us. And we got some really cool pictures of him, you know, of us all hanging around together. What it reminded me of, to me, it was kind of like when the Beatles came to America in 1964 and they hung out with Cassius Clay. I don't know if you're aware of that, you know, but there was some wonderful, they were in Miami and they went to Cassius Clay's training camp and they had these great pictures of the four of the Beatles in a ring with Cassius Clay and they're all, you know, clowning around. It was really fun. So that was kind of my version of getting to meet Cassius Clay.
Okay. And your album, of course, like Gangbusters, that those three singles came from that. That was probably your better known album, but you also had other albums obviously as well, and you're now re-releasing those albums in Cooking Vinyl, re-releasing the albums with updated material. So tell me how this is coming about.
Well, that's kind of a question for Chris Bostock, our bass player. He's the guy that's kind of making everything happen like that, you know. I'm here in Los Angeles doing completely other things and just kind of keeping in touch with Chris. And he tells me we're doing this. I'm going, okay, you know, all right, great. You know, he's the one that's got in touch with Cooking Vinyl and kind of made all that happen, because the second album never really came out. You know, we recorded three albums. The second one never really came out. Third one never came out because, you know, we had a lot of contractual issues, a lot of problems with the record companies. We misbehaved terribly, as a lot of bands do, for a number of reasons. It was the business. The business of it was, we weren't very good at the business. And Bernie Rhodes was our manager in the beginning, you know, from The Clash. But then once we got signed to RCA and things started happening, Bernie walked away. And then we were kind of not managed very well. And we weren't businessmen. You know, we were musicians and we were young and full of beans and just, you know, wanted to have a good time and drink and chase girls and write songs. And somebody needed to be taking care of the business, and it wasn't getting taken care of properly. And it cost us in the end. But it's great that those songs are coming out now, you know, so people could hear them, because I think we were a great band. We were a really good band. We were great songwriters. And I mean, that was evident in the songs that people actually heard. So, and it just got better. I think we became much better songwriters. So the second album was very good and good songs. So we're getting to play those songs. People can buy those songs now and hear them. And it's kind of exciting after all those years to finally those songs to get them, you know, get heard.
Yeah, because there's been a 35-year gap between 85 when you originally split up to 2020. So yeah. How do you get back together again? How did it all come back?
Well, again, it's Chris Bostock. You know, Chris is the mastermind of it all. He's been trying to get me to do this for many, many years. He's like, you know, every year he'd be like, "Dig, come on, we got to do a reunion. We got to do this. We got to do that." And I just wasn't ready. I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't want to. And you know, it's different being the singer. You know, if you're the guitar player, or the bass player, or the drummer. You know, I mean, those positions are very important to the band. But if you're the singer, you've got to stand there and sing those songs. And you got to feel like singing those songs. I didn't feel like singing those songs for all those years. I just didn't. And maybe it's because, some of it left a bad taste in my mouth. You know, the way things kind of fell apart and way, you know, because we had big hopes that we were going to become massive. And, you know, it didn't happen. And luckily, I got to the point where I realized I quit blaming anybody else. And I realized, you know, the success that we had was pretty good. It was pretty good. You know, it took a while for me to be able to look back on it in hindsight and say, you know, that was pretty good. I think all the bands who never even got record contracts, you know, let alone get hit records. So, to look at it like that, say, man, we were very fortunate to have what we had. But enough time had to pass. And then when I finally did feel like doing it and said, okay, Chris, I'm ready. Then the pandemic,
yeah,
you know, and it was kind of tough because, you know, when I finally get myself ready to do it, and then it's like, we can do it. And then we had to wait. And we tried it twice and the pandemic shut us down twice. So this time, the third time was kind of like, okay, it looks like this one's going to happen, you know, but I had to get myself back up for it again. I started listening to the songs again, singing those songs again and thinking about it, you know, and just preparing myself for that. And luckily, since I've been doing that and listening to the songs and getting ready for this tour, you know, I fell in love with the songs again. And I'm thinking, God, I wrote those lyrics. Yeah, it's a pretty good song. You know, I can kind of, having stepped back from it, I can look at it now. And I'm quite excited about actually doing it.
Brilliant. And the current lineup is very much like the original lineup?
All the same guys, all five of us. Everybody's, you know, all the same people, which is pretty good. I was talking to Dave, the piano player, the other day. He lives here in the States. Well, he's in Chicago. You know, we were talking about, you know, how basically 40 years later, how many bands, you know, five guys in a band, 40 years pass, how many of them are still alive? You know, that's the reality of it, you know, and the fact that we're all still alive, have all our faculties, you know, so much. I guess we'll see when we start rehearsing, we'll see how many gigabytes, you know, so-and-so's lost. But right now, everybody seems to be in good health. And, you know, so I think we're quite fortunate. It's kind of one of those things that, it took a long time to happen, but now that it's happening, it seems to be the right time.
Brilliant. And will there be new material? Now you've got the old material, obviously you're redoing the old material, but are you going to be looking at doing some new stuff as well?
No, all the songs, we got so many songs, we got so many songs we're not doing, you know, so no one's written anything new. I mean, I'm a published poet. You know, so I've got a room full of poems that I've been writing, but I don't write them as lyrics. I write it as poetry. And Dave, our piano player, Dave Collard, he heard a couple of my poems. He goes, that's a pretty good song lyric. So he sent me some music. He goes, maybe that's going to be a song. And we talked about it, but it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. I'm not a songwriter anymore. I'm a poet.
Okay. And how about social media and websites? Have you got any of those?
Well, me personally?
No, the box, Joe Boxers.
Well, there's a website, boxers.net, joeboxers.net, I think is the, again, Chris is the man with all that. Yeah, he would be reeling off all kinds of things like that for you. But I know it's joeboxers.net. That's the website.
Okay, and, brilliant. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you, Adig, and great to have you back after all these years.
That's terrific. Nice talking to you, Jason. Thank you so much for your interest.
Livewire is produced by Steve Osborne Media. Steve Osborne Media.